From Jersey Shore to Indiana, Beaver Falls to Lebanon, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, all the talk in Harrisburg is about raising your taxes, but a Taxpayer Protection Act is making its way through the Senate that could put a cap on any tax hike. David Taylor is joined by Matt Briette and Kevin Shivers for a Capital Watch roundtable discussion. And the 2016 presidential race is off and running, but voters in Pennsylvania will likely have no say in who the parties nominate for the highest office in the land. I'll have a town hall commentary on why it is time to move the Pennsylvania primary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, this week's news headlines from the Pennsylvania Independent.
Hello and welcome to the weekly PA Independent Capital Watch News Update. I'm Eric Baim. Our top story this week, in the tiny borough of Throop, Pennsylvania, a 5-square-mile patch of former hard coal country, home to about 4,000 people, Charlene Tomasovich needed just 700 votes to win her spot on the borough council in 2011. Getting on the borough council payroll required even fewer votes for the rest of her family. The councilwoman needed just 4 votes from her fellow council members for Throop to hire her father, her husband, and her son after she took office. Those ties are far from an anomaly in this small borough near Scranton, where council members are quick to say they don't use their official power to hire relatives, but are always more than happy to cast a vote in favor of employing a colleague's flesh and blood. In the process, the council has created an employee roster that might be mistaken for a family tree. Borough records show that local taxpayers have shelled out more than $250,000 since 2010 to fund jobs held by council persons' relatives. A review of payroll records covering 4 years show that at least 10 people related to 5 current council members and 1 former council member have worked for the borough. 6 of those relatives were hired after a family member took office, according to borough records, while another was promoted. Nobody is getting rich off the jobs. Most of them are part-time and usually have hourly salaries around $8 to $11. But still, good government groups say it's best to avoid even the appearance of impropriety in cases like this. For more, check out our 3-part series on Throop at paindependent.com. Elsewhere this week, the state house again passed a bill that would eliminate a special carve-out for labor unions in the state law that defines the crime of stalking. The exemption prevents labor union members who are engaged in a labor dispute from being charged with the crime. Republicans who are championing the change say that that's an invitation to harassment. But critics say that the bill is unnecessary and argue it would unwind safeguards that protect workers and management from facing criminal charges for activity that federal law permits during labor disputes. And finally this week, the Commonwealth Court spiked a school funding lawsuit, ruling that education spending is not in its wheelhouse. The lawsuit alleged that legislative leaders, state education officials, and the governor violated their constitutional obligation to provide a public education system that gives all children in Pennsylvania an equal opportunity to meet state-imposed academic standards. The Education Law Center and the Public Interest Law Center in Philadelphia had filed the suit on behalf of 6 school districts, 7 parents, and a few other pro-school spending groups. They were seeking to change the way schools are funded. They could now take their case to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, although similar cases have failed in the past. For the PA Independent, I'm Eric Baim. Check out these stories and more online at paindependent.com and find us on Facebook and Twitter at PA Independent.
Governor Tom Wolf is proposing to raise your personal income taxes, increase the sales tax and apply it to more goods and services, and tax businesses, big and small. But some legislators are working on a Taxpayer Protection Act that would place strict limits on future tax hikes. David Taylor, Matt Briette, and Kevin Shivers are here with details. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, president of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, my pal Kevin Shivers, executive state director of the National Federation of Independent Business. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, David.
And also, we have Matt Briette, president of Pennsylvania's foremost free market think tank, the Commonwealth Foundation. Matt, thanks for being on the program.
Hey, David. Hey, Kevin.
So we're on the scene in Harrisburg, PA, watching the public's business being conducted. And the of course, the issue of the day is the spending plan that will guide the Commonwealth going into next year. We've got until the end of the constitutional deadline at June 30 to get it done. And, you know, obviously that's the central point of our public policy discussion. How much of our economy is going to be claimed by the Commonwealth and how much is going to remain in the hands of the people who earned it?
Well, you know, when the governor unveiled his budget in back in March, you know, Democrats and Republicans that I've talked to, I mean, it was almost like it was, you know, a joke, and the punchline was this 14% increase in spending that nobody in Harrisburg, I think, is looking at the spending plan that the governor unveiled in a realistic way. And in fact, you know, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle that we talk to are frustrated because they have to come up with their own plan knowing that that is just unreasonable.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot like when I was a little kid that I would take the Sears catalog and the JCPenney Christmas catalog and I would dog ear like every page where I wanted something and gave it to mom
Santa,
and dad.
Please.
Yeah.
Santa.
Yeah.
But if you – I mean if it honestly, when you look at that spending plan though – it does. If you took a look at, you know, the governor's supporters, I mean, you know, there was a direct line, not a dotted line, but a direct line to each one of those organizations that run through that budget. You know, it really wasn't any thought that went into developing that plan. It was, you know, who can I thank and how can I pay them back?
Well, how unserious this is, we sit here today and there is no budget presented on behalf of the governor from any House Democrat.
I don't think it's even been introduced.
No, that's what I'm saying.
That's the point.
There's no spending plan. In fact, if there ever is one, I would suspect that you'd have a hard time even getting half of the Democrats in the House to vote for it because, I mean, this is a massive tax and spending plan that's going to clobber the middle class, the very people that they said, hey, that's who we're fighting
for. Yeah, that's their mantra.
And you know what's fascinating? You know, several years ago, under the Rendell administration, we enacted the independent fiscal office, right? Because there were some real questions about the numbers coming out of the governor's budget office and exactly, you know, are they cooking the books? What were the actual financial information. It's fascinating because when the governor unveiled his budget, he said there was a $2.5 billion structural deficit, and that's why we needed all of the spending to fill all of the holes, restore funding for education, etc. Well, now we're learning from the independent fiscal office. Well, he was a billion off. It actually is about $1.5 billion deficit
today, which means that his $4.5 billion tax increase is actually triple what the actual shortfall is in the state budget.
You know, we're going to take all we need and a little bit more.
Well, for many years, groups like ours have been petitioning for a limit, a constitutional limit on state government spending, something that we've called the Taxpayer Protection Act. And that this has been – I know it's only been 12 years?
Yeah.
Hey, good legislation takes time.
Well, this is the thing, but I do believe that we're making progress and that the Taxpayer Protection Act has been reintroduced, that Senator Fulmer from Lebanon County is the champion, that newly elected Senator Bartolotta from Washington County is joining that effort. There was an event at the Capitol and that both the Speaker of the House and the President Pro Tem were present to endorse that. And, you know, if you have a Taxpayer Protection Act whereby the increase in state government spending is limited to population growth and inflation, you have a much narrower band than what some of these big government advocates like Tom Wolf want to do.
Well, look, what we understand, and it's basic economics, basic political science, that government has no money of its own. It only has that which it first takes from us. Pennsylvania currently is the 10th highest state and local tax burden in the country. And that is because, well, we've spent a lot of money and we continue to extract a lot of taxpayers' paychecks and family budgets, business budgets. What the spending limitation does is says, let's slow the growth of state government using this index and say, all right, government can grow only so fast.
Right.
If you want to spend more, we're going to set a higher hurdle
right.
over which you
right.
must get. And that hurdle is saying, hey, 2/3 majority vote. Pretty simple. Other states have this. This has controlled the spending. And then it makes our legislators make their case to the people
yes.
of Pennsylvania why they need to spend more.
Yeah, and most importantly, it takes it from the realm of the abstract
yeah.
of you know all kinds of wonderful promises, and it actually ties it to the economic realities under which the people of Pennsylvania have to live. And so that's how you would establish real world limits on how much more of our economy the government could consume
well,
year over year.
And the way in which they're going about this, so Senator Mike Fulmer has the statutory act whereby this would be in statute that of course could be overturned by in the future
sure.
by another legislature. Which is always a challenge. If you're including a supermajority vote of 2/3, well, all you have to do is strike that law and then you can go mm-hmm. back to a simple majority. So what Senator Bartolotta has done is said, hey, we should have a constitutional amendment that would establish a spending limit and establish a threshold over which the legislature would have to get over before they spend beyond what is a reasonable spending limit. Of course, if you have a disaster, a natural disaster or something, and that the governor and the legislature agree to it, there are ways to make sure that this isn't
right.
a hard and fast spending
right.
limit, but it's going to make it much more difficult to get the kinds of spending
increases.
There would
have to be a broad-based
right.
consensus
and, you know,
to meet
and,
that kind of emergency.
And here's why this is important. Ever since 2009, 2010, I mean, there has been a concerted effort, to there's some restraint in terms of the growth of spending, especially in the last 4 years where we actually had a governor who was committed to that. But, you know, with this proposal, I mean, this is the poster child for why we need checks and balances between the legislative and executive branches.
Well, the challenge that we face, though, now that regarding the overall commitments by the Commonwealth for the taxpayers and from the taxpayers is the contract with the public employees that what the governor promises to the public employees that just goes on the books. There's no vote on the part of the General Assembly to accept whatever the contract is that the governor agrees to. And so, of course, you have Governor Wolf here sitting across the table from the people who funded his campaign.
Well, yeah, you've got 16 governmental unions that have contracts that are up June 30th of this year. They cover more than half of all the state employees in the state and account for over almost $3.5 billion in spending. And the negotiations between the governor and his number one campaign contributors is all behind closed doors in secret, really behind the very thing that the governor says he's for of openness and transparency. And so they've negotiated apparently, and we just learned that this week from the media that the governor has agreed to a one-year contract in which they're going to get a 2.25% increase. This during a time when he's saying, hey, we're $2 billion in the red. I don't know of any business out there giving pay increases when their revenues are below their expenditures.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, Kevin Shivers from Pennsylvania NFIB and Matt Briette from the Commonwealth Foundation. So the governor is, kicking the can down the road, just taking the what's been promised for 1 year, and then there will be more negotiations behind closed
doors?
Well,
look, as he's trying to get all these massive tax increases, he understands, hey, he's under the public scrutiny on these contracts with his number one campaign contributors. And the best way to kind of, push things off into the future, David, is let's agree to a one-year short-term contract. We'll come back to this in another year when maybe they've got some of these other issues solved. So I think that that's pretty much the agreement with AFSCME, That will then be the master agreement that flows to all the others, that I suspect all the other unions will follow suit. If he wants to win re-election in 2018, he's going to be fully dependent upon those unions.
That's exactly
and their contributions.
Right. And so
it's – yeah. So it makes great sense for him to make sure that he takes care of those number one campaign
contributors. And the transparency issue is, and that's another important piece that's moving through the General Assembly right now.
Tell me about that.
Legislation that is sponsored by State Senator Mike Fulmer that would add transparency to this particular contracting and the way that these contracts are developed.
Well, so Senator, Senator Fulmer's bill would require the Independent Fiscal Office to give a quantification of the impact of the contracts on the state budget. And so you'd actually start to get some numbers because right now it's whatever the governor negotiates. He then hands that bill to the legislature and says, you fund this.
And what's frightening about that is that, you know, that number is not, you know, the budget developed, no predication of, you know, what that negotiated amount is going to be. So right now we're moving on developing a state budget plan. This negotiation isn't even part of that budget presentation
far. And there are two other bills that are kind of companions, if you will, on this transparency. State Senator Ryan Ament wants to open up the negotiations to the Sunshine Law, basically saying when you have public officials coming together with union officials to negotiate, that you would then open this up to public scrutiny so that the public who are paying these bills would be able to provide some accountability to the discussions that are going on so that, hey, if the representative of the taxpayer is making their best offer and the representative of the unions is making wildish demands at the bargaining table, this comes out in the public and makes sure that the taxpayers are protected. So Senator Ament would open up that process. He'd still allow for executive sessions and such for strategy purposes, but say, hey, these things need to be more open to the public. And then Senator Stefano has a bill that would require a posting period so that the public can scrutinize what's in these contracts. And right now what happens is they get signed, then you get to see them. He says, no, let's have a waiting period essentially before they get signed so that the public can weigh in and that changes could be made if it's egregious.
You know, and just like the legislative process, right, there needs to be a cooling off process or a point at which the public can actually see and understand the terms that have been negotiated. Because right now the way that the circumstances work, you're in and after the fact and you're completely cut out of the process.
It would allow for informed consent.
Yeah. Indeed.
Well, Senator Andy Dinneman, Democrat from Chester County, was making arguments at the hearing saying, hey, if we allowed that kind of waiting period, the contract might collapse. And I said, yes, precisely.
It should withstand
public scrutiny.
A contract proposal that can't withstand public scrutiny ought not to be signed, and therefore, yes, it would be good if it collapsed.
That's right. He thought that that was a reason not to have this type of a waiting period, but that's precisely why we should.
And all of us, you know, as local property owners and you taxpayers at the local level, I mean, this is the same kind of frustration we see year in and year out dealing with local school taxes and others that, you know, school districts are negotiating behind closed doors with, you know, the teachers' unions or other governmental unions, and you have no idea what the terms are.
Well, you don't know where they're meeting. You don't know when they started negotiations, when they've ended. All of a sudden, you have a contract that's out there saying, hey, your property taxes are going up 10 or 12 or 20%, and you had no opportunity for any input. These bills would provide for greater public scrutiny so that you as taxpayers can make sure your voice is heard as unions are negotiating with your representatives.
So what is the status of the bills, Matt?
Yeah, they have passed out of committee, so they are on to the full Senate, and hopefully they will end up making it over to the House and to the governor's desk. And, well, what was interesting, the first comment that we heard from Governor Wolf was that he would consider them. So I don't think it's, you know, that he is adamantly opposed to that, at least not out of the gate. And we hope that he would be consistent with his claims of being open, transparent, and accountable and would support these kinds of measures of opening up the process.
Well, and it would also be consonant with his stand against gifts and the influence of Receiving things from these different special interests, because certainly that would be the greatest exchange of gifts that could be imagined.
Well, I'd say that this would be the first step of a probably 1,000-step journey on that, because this is the problem, of course, that FDR recognized and why he opposed collective bargaining in the public sector is the very thing that we're dealing
yes,
with.
He
that
opposed, you have, yeah, FDR was against
yes,
that.
Yeah, because here if you have an interest who has can have a monopoly over the workforce in a monopoly government, you effectively cede power or control to a private entity. Yeah.
Whereas unionization in the private sector, that you've got the marketplace derived earnings of the employer, and that it's about the union trying to get more from the employer, that in the public sector, it's the taxpayer.
Yeah.
That's right.
And the taxpayer is not a customer, because you don't choose whether or not you spend those dollars. And mm-hmm. again, it's an abuse of power, because it becomes compulsory.
Well, and you can then demand the world, right? I mean, yes. What prevents you from doing that? And that's exactly why you have some of the challenges in our urban areas, cities in particular, that are going bankrupt because of the collective bargaining process. And that's the irony in all this, is that these are Democratic strongholds, and you have Democratic mayors that are starting to call out their Democrat legislators in the House and Senate, saying, you guys have got to do something, because our cities are going to collapse
yes.
because of this collective bargaining
process. And again, it's what's been given away in benefits, in future benefits, yeah. by politicians in the past who said, I'll be on the beach with a drink in my hand by the time that this bill comes due.
Well, the poster child for that is the Philadelphia schools, right? You know, the public school system with the financial mess that they're in, born by just horrible decisions by the elected leaders in that school district for years, before.
But this is the thing. We need our government to function. We need these core functions to be properly fulfilled.
Let
and upheld.
The sun shine in, and that's going to be a big
and that's exactly
right.
That's
it really exactly
is the
right.
best disinfectant.
Well, so we've seen some progress on some good things in Harrisburg, PA, and so we will keep an eye on what's happening, and hopefully more of that sunshine will flow in. Well, guys, we're just about out of time, so let's go around the horn here. Kevin, where can people go to learn more about you and your organization?
You can visit nfib.com/PA, or you can join the conversation on Twitter at @NFIB_PA.
Outstanding. And Matt, what about you and your team?
Yes, please go to commonwealthfoundation.org. Sign up for our email updates. We'll keep you apprised what's going on in your state capital and how you can take action as well.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at www.pamanufacturers.org and also on the Pennsylvania Cable Network Sunday afternoons at 5:30 with PMA Perspective. So for Kevin and Matt and myself, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. The 2016 presidential race has officially begun. Over the past couple of weeks, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, and Hillary Clinton have formally announced their candidacies. The field of Republican candidates likely will total a dozen or more. Hillary Clinton's early stumbles make the entry of former Virginia Senator Jim Webb and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley more likely. With no incumbent president in the race, voters in both the Republican and Democratic primaries will actually have a choice in 2016. It is a contest voters in Pennsylvania will likely watch from the sidelines. By the time our state's April primary is held, results of primaries and caucuses elsewhere will have determined the eventual nominees. Only one time in recent years, 2008, has the Pennsylvania primary actually mattered. That year, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama battled for the Democratic nomination until June, before Mrs. Clinton conceded. Democrats had a choice, but John McCain had been ordained the GOP nominee months earlier. Every 4 years, the debate begins anew about Pennsylvania's lack of clout in the presidential nominating process, owing to the lateness of its primary. And every 4 years, absolutely nothing is done to correct the problem. Pennsylvania is the sixth largest state in the nation. More so than perhaps any other state, we are a microcosm of the nation as a whole. With Philadelphia, we have a large eastern city while Pittsburgh has more of a Midwestern orientation. We have large, thriving suburbs and expansive rural areas. Our population is diverse. Statewide elections in Pennsylvania tend to be competitive, with both parties having shown recent success. An early primary in Pennsylvania would be a much more accurate indicator of voter preference than Iowa or New Hampshire, which are smaller and less diverse. Those two states lead off the balloting in January. February 2nd is shaping up as a mini Super Tuesday, with New York, Minnesota, Colorado, and Utah holding primaries on that date. It would be an ideal time for primary voters in Penn's Woods to go to the polls and give us a real say in the nomination process. Instead, nearly three more months and 24 other states will hold primaries or caucuses before Pennsylvanians vote. All of this means Keystone State voters will have virtually no say in which candidates the parties nominate. Making matters worse, Pennsylvania's presidential primaries are essentially beauty contests, in that the outcome of the balloting has little or no impact on the selection of delegates to the party nomination conventions. Delegates are selected in separate elections and/or by party state committees, meaning presidential candidates must line up slates of delegate candidates months before the primary. This is a process they tend to bypass in favor of focusing their efforts on the early primary and caucus states. Moving Pennsylvania's primary to an earlier date poses a logistical challenge. It would require holding a separate primary in February for presidential balloting and a regular primary in May for selecting congressional and legislative nominees. Or the entire process could be moved from April to February. Holding two primaries would increase cost, while holding congressional and legislative elections in February would advance the start of the process into the previous year's holiday season. The cost of an additional primary must be weighed against the economic benefits it would generate. New Hampshire Public Radio, based on a study of the 2000 presidential primary, when both party nominations were up for grabs, estimated the economic impact at $230 million. The economic benefits to Pennsylvania, a much larger state, would be significantly higher. Dollars aside, the major drawback to Pennsylvania's late presidential primary is the absence of our voters having any real say in the selection of party nominees. We are a large state, and we deserve better. But it is a problem nobody in Harrisburg seems willing to address. With a town hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, well, audio of our complete program is always available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and PATownHall.com. You can also hear us on VoiceOfPA.net. For 20 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth. They include WPHVAM in Somerset, WXMT-FM in Smithport, along with WOWY-FM, WEMR-FM, and WBHV-FM in the State College, Pennsylvania area. If you would like to comment on this program or suggest topics for future shows, please email us at LincolnRadioJournal@gmail.com. That's LincolnRadioJournal@gmail.com, or visit our page on Facebook. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute, completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations. They include the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Wayne, and the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.